Hello and welcome to Open Book, a podcast by National Records of Scotland dedicated to preserving Scotland's past, recording its present and informing our future. This week we have a talk by the writer E.S. Thompson, author of The Peach Grower's Almanac, Dark Asylum and other novels set in the Victorian era. Elaine visited us at General Register House in Edinburgh's New Town to tell us how archives have inspired her and how the stories of real people can help to develop and inform creative writing. She also looked into some of the strange cases from 19th century Scottish courts that inspired elements of her own fiction, including a man transported to Australia for the pettiest of thefts, a body-snatching medical student with parental issues, and a particularly tragic case involving the murder of a newborn infant, a form of crime that was surprisingly common. It's a fun and interesting talk, and if you're a budding writer yourself, you might find it helpful in creating some pulp fiction of your own.
Thanks for coming in today, everybody. I can see the weather has kept a few people away, but you people are obviously keen to know more, so hopefully I can tell you a few interesting things as we proceed. I'm introduced as Elaine there, which is great. I'd like you to call me Elaine rather than ES, which would be a bit weird. An S doesn't actually mean anything. I was just told to abbreviate my name because to try and hide my gender. Apparently people would rather buy books from a man than a woman. So in order to try and conceal the fact that I am a woman, there's like a second between reading the front and turning it over and seeing my picture, during which time I think people are supposed to, you know, they're convinced they're going to buy it, then they flip it over. And anyway, so yes, I'm Elaine Thompson. I do work at Edinburgh Napier, which is, I teach marketing, which is a bit strange considering my PhD is in the social history of medicine. But I draw on that PhD to write these novels, so I like to think that it's never been wasted. And in fact, when I finished the PhD, one of the things that concerned me about the interesting things that I'd looked at and that I'd discussed in that doctorate was that nobody was ever going to see them. That the only people who'd read my PhD was me, my supervisor, and the examiner. Then it's going to go in the library and never be seen again. But it was so interesting that a lot of the information that came out in my first novel, which was called A Proper Education for Girls, published under my married name as Elaine Di Rolo, that first novel contained a lot of the stuff that I'd covered in my PhD. And so that sort of in-depth historical information I've always found absolutely fascinating, and I've always felt that it should be in more places than just history books. I mean, it's great that it's in history books, but I think if we can get it out there to a wider public to try and bring it alive a bit, it's always been something that I've felt is really important as a historian, but also as somebody who's read a lot. I always read a lot as a child. I used to work in bookshops and so on. So fiction has always had a huge part in my life. So bringing them both together, I found I could actually write novels, which was a relief when all said and done. So I've published about five now. I've got one of them here that's not quite out yet. So I think what I write now, I started off with literary fiction, two novels that were literary fiction. What I write now is historical crime fiction, and these are the ones that you see behind you, Beloved Poison, Dark Asylum and The Blood, and they all draw very strongly on a medical history theme, because that was my background. And I try to draw on the past as closely as I possibly can, and using the National Archives has been really important there. So I think in all of these novels, and the ones I'm going to talk about today, some of the characters, some of the locations, some scenes and so on, have been taken directly or indirectly from some of the stuff that I found in this building. So I might be a trained historian, so I'm quite used to being in archives and looking at this kind of material and so on. So that doesn't necessarily make me a better writer of historical fiction just because I've done a PhD. I think anyone could try their hand at historical fiction if you are interested. And if you come somewhere like this, you can really get a flavour of how people spoke and how they lived, and that can really inform any creative writing that you might undertake. Now, I like using these kind of records in particular because you see the real voices of people who lived and worked in Edinburgh. They're people just like you and I. A lot of the things I'm going to talk about, it's just normal, everyday people. It's not the great and the good. It's not necessarily people who wrote books or kept records that we might want to read. It's accounts that come from real people, and I found that particularly interesting because it's a voice in history that we don't often hear. History often written down by, well, in my case, doctors and so on. They're the ones whose voices we read. But if we look at some of these things, precognitions and so on, then you do get a deeper sense of how people used to live. So I think there are things in the reading room, if you've been there. I don't know if you've been in the reading room before. Hopefully you have. If you haven't, you should try it. It's great. But it can be a bit alarming. It's very quiet. There's no speaking and everyone's quiet. So the quiet staff and the quiet room, the quiet readers all are looking at their stuff. And you're going to use a pencil and there's these strange weights you must put on the documents. And the documents are often really dirty. And the handwriting can look impenetrable. And just when you think you've got the gist of one set of handwriting, you look at another document and it's even smaller, or it's been written in a hurry, or they have a long S in the middle of the word, you know, so it looks like an F. So it can be a bit difficult reading these kind of things. I even had one, it looked like it had been stuffed up a chimney, and it was black. It came to me in a plastic bag, and it was covered in black stuff. And I had it all over my hands and my face by the end of the day. I went to the toilets afterwards and was covered in smuts. But I thought at the time, where did this come from? Has it been stored up a chimney? Why would you put a document up a chimney? And that made me think, I could put that in a novel, couldn't I? Somebody's hidden a document up a chimney. Why would you do that? So I think you can get your inspiration from anywhere, whether it's the content or even getting a dirty document and wondering where it's been can be a little thing that might lead you forward in a story. So I think you look for your creative inspiration from anywhere. One of the things I think is quite important about using archive sources is that I believe it's quite rare to find one document that's going to give you the whole story, the beginning, the middle, and the end. You know, I'm just going to tell that story. There may be some crimes that you could tell a story about in that way. For example, the Eugene Contrell that I think you've got downstairs. Have you got that one downstairs? So that's a malice aforethought case, which, of course, you could write up as a novel, as a piece of creative fiction as well. But I've never used archives for that reason. I kind of prefer this sort of lucky dip effect that you can call up anything from down there, anything from the criminal records, and you will find something interesting, something that you can use in some way for writing historical fiction. Of course, most crimes that we'll see in these documents, most crimes are pretty straightforward. They're often unhappy people making mistakes. The crimes of passion is maybe a jealous rage, a loss of temper, a drunkenness. I've got a grave robber. He's just, you know, he's not nicking a body because he wants to, but he wants to train to be a doctor. So what else can he do? So, they're not these sort of malice aforethought complicated cases that we might see on Rebus or, that sounds like I'm criticising Ian Rankin. I'm not. You know, the things that we get on the TV that are very complicated, that kind of thing. That's for us as a novelist to make more interesting for people as readers. But I think reality is far more simple and maybe far more basic and tragic. So, of course, a novel is made up of more than just plot. So along with that, we have the locations and characters and things of that kind. And here, the National Records have been a great source to me. It's a great place to come and look for material about the past, but also, as I say, that insight into how ordinary people lived their lives. And most notably, it's precognitions that I found particularly useful. I don't know whether you've ever seen a precognition. I'm quite new to them, and I've found them really quite refreshing and quite exciting as a new sort of source to look at. And they can be quite detailed. Some of them are really thick. And a precondition is a record of the preliminary examination of witnesses to decide whether there is ground for a trial. So you have accounts of different witnesses who will have all told you what happened, you know, leading up to the event and what their understanding was of the event. And this is where you get the voices of real people, which I think is really interesting to all of us as individuals to read voices from the past that may be our relatives or our ancestors. Or so it could be any of them because they're just normal people. So most of these things you'll find held under shelf mark AD 14, or you can follow it up through case trials, which are held under JC 26. So you can have a look for those things. Loads of papers to look at. You can look up using keywords also. My favourite ones at the moment are lodging house. Yeah, lodging, because loads of bad things happening in lodging houses. So if you put lodging house in, and then AD 14, you get all these terrible things that happened in lodging houses. I did the same with hotels and found quite an interesting case. But also transportation, murder, doctor, apothecary, physician, surgeon. Those have been my main keywords for looking for interesting things. And Glasgow and Edinburgh, again, it's those urban crimes that have particularly interested me with the sort of fiction that I've written. I've never called up a single document that I've thought, well, that was a bit dull. Never think that. All of the documents that you call up, there's always something interesting in them. So I think if you go there, just pop in with your keyword, find something, a precognition. It will be interesting to you. There's just something about them to read these little snippets of the past that is so exciting. So I've got three cases that I was going to talk to you about that I've used in my fiction. And I've got three short readings. I'm not going to go on and on. Short readings to try and show you where I've used those cases in my work. So my novels aren't based on a case. It's this idea of this lucky dip approach. Come in, take a precognition from the relevant area that you've found using a particular key search word, and you know what is it in that that's been of interest to me? It's always been a delight to find yourself using things that you didn't expect to use. So the first case that I have is this one. This is a copy of the photograph of the precognition of Alexander Smith from 1831. Alexander Smith is accused of stealing a handkerchief by taking it from the pocket of John Miller outside the Waterloo Hotel. So I picked this for a number of reasons, one of them being it's pretty much right here. It was this part of town, because it's just down there, isn't it? It's just down there when this terrible crime took place in 1831. And this is what happened. This terrible thing took place, which is Alexander Smith, presently in custody, stands charged with wickedly and feloniously stealing and theftuously taking away from one of the back coat pockets of John Miller, ironmonger, Grassmarket, at or near the Waterloo Hotel, a chocolate, crimson and white silk handkerchief, the property or in the lawful possession of the said John Miller. So it's quite wordy, isn't it? That theftuously, that was a new word for me, which I'm quite glad to say is no longer really used very often. Because one of the things I quite liked about that was the triviality of the crime. I mean, liked it, but it, you know, it's interesting how trivial the crime is. The way the handkerchief is described over and over again in these rather pompous terms. It's never red, white and brown. It's always chocolate, crimson and white. And there's also a kind of, you know, does anyone remember Blackadder? There's Lord Melchett and the trial of the plump-breasted pigeon. The language is rather like that, you know, with beastliness aforethought. Which I thought was quite intriguing. But so that case was quite interesting. For that reason, the language that is used to describe what has happened to him. But also, what else is interesting about this? These other notes. I mean, as a historian, I should really pay attention with, you know, what these documents are. As a writer of crime fiction, it doesn't matter what these documents are. It's just what's in them that speaks to me as a writer. So I'm not going to give you all the details of which is which. But this particular document is from the Crown agent, as you can, I think you can see from the bottom of the photocopy there. But what was interesting is that there's trouble with boys in Edinburgh in the early 19th century. Arguably, we still have a bit of a worry about youths, don't we? Youths in hoodies, hanging about, doing things, and you know, being disreputable on street corners. Well, the same problem in 1831. And so we see that this chap here, this unfortunate Alexander Smith, there are a considerable number of thieves about the same age as Smith at present going about the town. And in concert with one another, Smith is understood to be one of the gang. I mean, that was pretty much that, and the fact that he admitted that he'd been twice in the Bridewell for theft, which is a formatory for petty criminals just down the road that no longer exists. So we did have an Edinburgh Bridewell until the mid-19th century. So he's been inside twice for theft. He's 13. Did I tell you that? He's 13 years old. Okay, and anybody guess what his fate was? He's transported, yes, so transportation. And again, this was interesting because we think this is just like something from Dickens, a bit of, you know, a bit overhyped. Oh, surely not. Transported for stealing a handkerchief. Yes, 7 years transportation. So this 13-year-old lad, I've got sons who are 14 and 12, so, you know, imagine that. Imagine my youngest, who's 13 in the new year, being transported for stealing a handkerchief because he'd been in trouble twice before and happens to hang out with a bunch of lads about the town. We've had enough of him. Get rid of him. You know, three strikes and you're out kind of thing. Tough times, I think, in the 19th century. So I liked that. The boy gangs were interesting. That fear of youth that I think we still kind of have. You know, it's deep-seated. We've always worried about folk hanging around, young people hanging around. The severity of the sentence on such a young person was interesting. The language of the court, you know, with this rather pompous language that's used throughout. So I used this case for my character in one of my novels. I was just going to read you a small bit from him, if you don't mind about this. If I've probably lost the page now. There it is. So this informed a character in my novel who's called Joe Silks, weirdly enough, because he steals silk handkerchiefs. But I don't mention it's a crimson chocolate and white one. Right, OK, so it's just a short section. It's about a page. We passed the wrought iron gates to the hospital, the grubby yellow glow of a candle visible through the window of the porter's lodge. Further along, a line of ragged children were huddled together against the infirmary wall. Beneath them, the iron ventilation gratings of the furnace room. There were often children lying on the gratings. They slept there, wrapped up in sacks and old newspapers like bundles of rubbish. The porter tried to move them along, but they always came back again. Dr. Bain knew each of them by name. He was often seen with a line of them following him down the road to the pie shop at the end of the street. Dr. Magorian was not so charitable. It threatened to engulf us all, he said, that tide of human misery and degradation. To leave them to die of cold and hunger would be a kindness, as the poor were so numerous that it was impossible to go anywhere without them, quite literally falling over them. Not two streets away from St. Saviour's lay the children's neighbourhood, Prior's Rents, a savage colony of blackened, decayed tenements, teeming with the most wretched examples of humanity. Their corpses filled St. Saviour's churchyard to bursting and provided Will Quatermain with his ghastly work. The children's ringleader was a lad called Joe Silks, a snitcher of handkerchiefs by trade. He had appeared amongst the ragged children about 2 years earlier, and after a series of scraps and brawls had succeeded in assuming a leadership role. Dr. Bain, Joe's rough-edged voice, cried out from amongst a mound of greyish rags as we drew close. Dr. Bain, there's a man what's looking for you. So Joe Silks goes on to have quite an important role in this novel, and his role as a sort of a child of the streets and a stealer of handkerchiefs becomes something of some significance. I knew that the children were sent abroad, sent away and transported for stealing loaves and handkerchiefs, but to actually find a case where that happened in Edinburgh, down the road from here, I thought was really, you know, quite intriguing. So it doesn't form the basis of my novel, but it's a character, it's a thing, it's an event that informed what I wrote. We have another case here on the end there. That's the case of... he had two names, because his alias, you see. Angus MacLean, alias James Murray. So he'd already been transported, and he's sent down to the Hulks. And he's at the Hulks in Woolwich. And due to an administrative error, his name wasn't taken when they were putting a working party to go and work on the shore. So he escapes. And he goes to the West Country, then he comes up to Glasgow, and he finally comes back over to Edinburgh, which is where he'd started off. And he's found in a close in Edinburgh, hanging around, and actually it's in a pub in the Grass Market, these days full of tourists, then full of thieves. It's in a pub chatting about thievery with a bunch of other known criminals, and in come the policemen chasing him up the close. There's a rather violent altercation on the close, and he's dragged off back into custody. But he's escaped from being transported. So that idea of being transported, often for petty crimes, for trying to come back, escaping from transportation, I thought was really intriguing and interesting. And I had a little bit of that in Dark Asylum, a short excerpt of which I will read to you. Because it's not about... I looked up quite a lot about transportation because I thought it was a really interesting thing to experience. And so what would that be like? So I have a little description here for you of a ship that would have taken someone like Joe Silks or like Angus MacLean and taken them to Australia and presumably just left them there. The Norfolk carried prisoners, both men and women, as well as free passengers, in addition to sailors and soldiers, so there were lots of us on board. I was used to crowds and small spaces, all of us were, but I could not believe how many hundreds of us were to be crammed inside that wooden prison. Some of the women said it had been a slave ship before. And when we were herded below into the terrible hutches where we were to spend much of our journey, I could well believe it. We were berthed in two rows of bunks, double height, hard against the creaking hull of the ship. A narrow walkway ran in between, and iron gates divided our prison into sections. The place was airless and dark, noisy and stinking, so that many of us were sick straight away, for we were none of us used to the rolling, heaving movement of the waves. But there was little that might be done about it, for the captain had his orders, and we were kept down there, ironed to our berths, for many days, until we had left England far behind. At last, after a week or more of being close-quartered, we were taken on deck, where we were lined up to be inspected by the captain and crew, the soldiers and officers, and the ship's surgeon. This last was a man of some influence, the captain being a rough man more interested in the seas and the wind than with the well-being of his passengers, and concerned only that we got to the bay without mutiny or loss of life. He said as much, and told us we might have a peaceful journey if we kept quiet and caused no trouble. He showed us the cat, a fearful tangled whip of knotted hide, and pointed to the triangle where we might be bound and the cramping box in which we might be crushed should we choose to ignore his advice. Our transport was to last 100 days, the captain said, perhaps more, but certainly no less. So transportation is quite a feature in this novel. And again, although you don't find accounts of what it was like being transported in these documents, it's the fact that trivial crimes, no wonder people wanted to escape from being transported, sent away from their friends and family. And that this chap, Angus MacLean, he comes right back to the scene of his crime because that's what he knows. That's where everybody is that he knows. So my character also returns to the scene of the crime. So that's transportation, and you can use transportation as a key word. There are a number of documents that will allow you to see the sorts of cases that were involved in sending people abroad. So the next case I wanted to sort of bring to your attention was the precognition of Jane McClintock for culpable homicide in 1894. So we're now moving to the end of the 19th century. And this case, I found this case interesting and horrifying in equal measure. And it wasn't the only case of this kind that I came across. There was a number of them that I'd looked at. In fact, I was doing some research for my job at Napier University, and I was looking at hotels that particularly interested me because I'm in the business school, blah, blah. I won't bore you with that at the moment, but I was looking up stuff about hotels, and I found this case, and I was so taken with the way it's all set out, that again, I put this sort of almost directly, this case itself, into a novel. Now, what had happened about Jane McClintock is this. She killed her child. What was she accused of? Now, the fiscal's petition tells us that Jane McClintock, now in custody, did on the 11th or 12th of June 1894 in the North British Station Hotel, George Square, Glasgow, where she was employed as a scullery maid, assault her female child to which she had just given birth, and did attempt to strangle her, and did violently beat or knock her head against some hard substance and fracture her skull, and did murder her on otherwise time and place above libelled the said Jane McClintock, who was delivered of a female child now dead, and did conceal her pregnancy, and did not call for or use assistance at the birth, contrary to the Act 40, George III, Chapter 24. So there's an act saying if you conceal your pregnancy and don't seek help when you're giving birth and anything happens, you can end up in court. It's a criminal action to do that. So it's called concealment of pregnancy, which you can imagine many girls get themselves or get into trouble. I shouldn't say get themselves into trouble. It's not like it happens on their own, does it? They get into trouble. They're abandoned by their seducer, which is what happened to this woman, and they're left with the consequences. And they're often young, and they're in precarious work. And how terrible it must have been. What do? Your family are far away, you don't have any friends, you're in a big city. This girl comes from Fife, only 18 years old. She's in Glasgow. So it's a horrifying case for which we can only feel terrible sympathy for the girl. So what has actually happened? That's what the fiscal says. What actually happened? She gave birth alone at the top of the hotel. She ripped the cord with her bare hands. She throttled the baby. She bashed its head against something, probably the chest in her bedroom. She went down the stairs and put the dead baby in the coal because she was so horrified. Put it in the coal and go away. And then she thought, actually, I can't do that because the other maid's coming in and she'll see the baby in the coal. So she takes it away and she puts it in her trunk in her bedroom and hides it. And she tries to tidy up the mess, which she can't do. So she's in a terrible state with this, the things that she's done here. And so we have here, which I thought was quite an interesting, this is there's a sort of plea put forward to try and treat this girl as leniently as possible. She's described as being 18 years of age, hardworking and alone, her mother being in Fife, her seducer having deserted her months ago, and so that you know, mitigation should be taken into account. And I thought the language that we see here is quite interesting as well. She's hoping against hope that something would intervene to help her before it was too late. So people ask her, are you pregnant? She says, no. Are you pregnant? No. She keeps saying no, and everyone's asking. No, she says, because she doesn't know how to deal with it. She's hoping it'll sort itself out or go away. It never does. And so the final consequences that are particularly tragic, I think. So there's a number of documents that come with this case. Another one is this one, that's saying if she told us she was pregnant, if she just said something about it, she could have been helped in some way. But she's just so horrified and so alarmed and frightened that she just can't do anything about it. So if she'd only spoken up. So this case was interesting to me for a number of reasons, because it's taking place in this hotel. So you've got all these guests, and meanwhile on the top floor, this terrible thing is taking place. This girl gives birth on her own. It's a really busy time. I think I said it was June, so it's summertime. The hotel is really busy. So she disappears upstairs to give birth, and everyone else kind of sort of gone downstairs, because you think, how can you give birth quietly on your own? But she sort of manages it because everyone's cleared out from these rooms while she's giving birth, and no one hears her. But also this sort of the nature of women's work in this period. She's been to this hotel before. She goes away. She comes back. So you get this sense of women's work being really sort of transitory, that they don't stay in a job for ages, that they come and go. So this idea of a really precarious way of living is also quite apparent. But she seems to have friends people are speaking up for and trying to make sure that she's not accused of murdering the baby, that she doesn't sort of suffer the ultimate fate. She's not hanged for killing the baby or anything like that. The next one I'm going to show you, I think, this is from the precognition itself, which we might have some pieces of it out there. And the bits that have been underlined there are the bits when she actually denies that she was pregnant. So what you get from this is the voice of people speaking. So I've underlined the bits that I've got here. On Monday the 11th, the prisoner was ill and confined to bed. For some days previously, it was rumoured and spoken amongst the servants that the prisoner was pregnant. I asked her. She denied it. She said that she would be all right if she saw a doctor, but still held out that she was not with child. I told Miss Stewart, the manageress, and I understood the doctor was being called in. About 1 o'clock the next morning, Tuesday the 12th, I was told by the vegetable maid, who knew such a thing existed, the vegetable maid, that the prisoner's room, in which she also slept, was in an awful mess. I went in and saw the prisoner in bed. I saw blood under the bed and traced it to her chest and to the water closet, and I found blood on the seat. She said she had had a miscarriage and that it was down the water closet. I did not believe her. The body of the child was in the chest, and she begged me not to tell anyone. The child was black with coal dust. The prisoner told me she had first put the child in the coal cellar but had moved it to avoid giving the laundry maid a fright. And then we have this bit that I've got on this page here. I think it's this page here. Agnes Robertson, the laundry maid, asked me if I had heard that it was thought McClintock was in the family way. This is from Jean Stewart, the housekeeper. I said no. Thereupon, I asked the witness, Scott, second laundry maid, to ask McClintock if she was in that way. She went and saw her and returned, saying the girl denied it. I then went to McClintock and said, well, Janie, I believe Scott has been asking you some questions. I'm glad to hear it's not true, both for yourself and for the house. And she said, no, Miss Stewart, it's not true. So you get these denials over and over again. You get this dialogue presented to us that we can read of the housekeeper asking the other servants, getting what she wants to hear as a denial, and then going and saying, well, Janie, I have heard these things. I hope it's not true for you and the house, you know, for the hotel, for the reputation of us all. No, miss, it's not true. So you get this really frightened dialogue coming out from these pages, which is quite affecting to read, you know, that somebody has gone through all of this terrible experience. So what actually happens to Jane McClintock in the end? She's sentenced to 3 years penal servitude. So she goes to prison. She's accused of concealment of pregnancy because she denied it and been asked over and over again, and she always said no. And then she gives birth on her own, and the baby drew breath. She killed it. She's given penal servitude rather than anything else because she gets this plea in her favour. So I thought this is one of the ones that I found quite affecting, and I used that whole case in this novel. Not as the whole story isn't about that, but I've got a character here, and I wanted this to be the story behind one of the characters in this novel, that she'd murdered this baby. And I also wanted to try and capture something of the language and the presentation of a precognition. So I have this. This is part of the confession of Mary Mercer on arriving at Siren House. And Siren House, in this novel, is the home for fallen women on the waterfront. Okay, so when the girls arrive, they give a confession. They have to say what they've done in the past that's brought them to the home for fallen women. And I use that case for the confession of Mary Mercer. So this is what I wrote. "Well, sirs, I knew they would take her away from me if they found out, and so I concealed my condition. My mother called the doctor, who looked at me and asked whether I was pregnant, and I said, 'No, sir.' But it was just that I had got fatter and was feeling unwell, and it was nothing that some castor oil wouldn't solve. My mother asked me the same question, and I said no to her, though I knew I was. And I still did not know what I would do when my time came. But come it did, one afternoon in August, when everyone was about their business as the harvest was being brought in. I felt the pains and I crept away to my tiny room at the top of the house. It was in the middle of the day when the maids' rooms were empty, and I bit down on a leather strap I had taken from the tack room to stifle my cries. I hardly knew what I should do when the baby came. I thought I could manage it alone, but I could not. The pain all but drove me mad, and I ripped the cord with my bare hands. The baby, a boy, was not moving. There was blood everywhere. I tried to clear it up, but I was weak and in pain. I could hardly move, and more of the stuff was pouring out of me. The baby was dead. I could see that, and so I put it in the coal scuttle and closed the lid, and then I lay down. Oh, sir, I can hardly say what happened next. My mother came looking for me and found me where I was. The doctor came, and a bloody trail showed where my baby was hidden. After that, I went quite mad. Insanity of childbirth, they say. And I was taken to an asylum and kept there for days until I was quiet. I almost died, sir. And I wish I had, for what awaited me now but the assizes. Because I had hidden my condition from everyone and had put the dead child in the coal scuttle, I was charged with concealment of pregnancy. They told me I would be convicted, but that I should be glad I was not charged with murder, for so I would have been had the doctor not agreed that my baby was already dead when I put it in the coal scuttle, for murder is a capital offence, and I should surely have hanged for it." So that you can see that actual, it's a terrible, tragic case, and I thought, I just felt I had to use that somehow, not in a humorous way at all, but as a, you know, a serious and tragic, you know, thing that would happen to so many women. Have I got all of these? That was the last... I think that's the last one I've got. The death was due to fracture of the skull, laceration of the brain. It's a medical officer's report, which we have here, and it makes really quite traumatic reading because they give you a very detailed account of the post-mortem. How did they know the baby was alive when it was born? They can tell its drawn breath, so they have to indicate that that was the case. Well, in my story, I wanted the baby to already be dead, but for, you know, rather than to have her actually kill it. So she just hid the baby, so I made it less of an awful crime. But this one was actually alive, and it was treated brutally. It's terrible to read. So we have it here, but, you know, beware if you choose to look at that you you may be reading something unpleasant. And there we go, you see that the medical report was so bad that a plea of concealment wasn't enough. So if you just conceal your pregnancy, that's far more minor crime than if you've done it, your baby to death. And it was such a terrible medical officer's report, because the violence upon the child was so great that they couldn't just have it as concealment of pregnancy. It had to be culpable homicide also was the crime she was charged with. But that takes us now on to James Carmichael from the autumn of 1823 for the fabulous sounding crime of violating the sepulchres of the dead, which sounds fabulously gothic and indeed really is. This is quite extraordinary because I think you all know what this is referring to. This is grave robbing, right, or raising the dead, which is like making them live again, it almost sounds like. But violating the sepulchres of the dead has that fabulous gothic ring to it. And again, there's a number of these cases that we can see here. And I want to bring this one to your attention because it's a medical history case, and that's my world. I'm using it in the novel I'm writing now, so that's a secret tantalising thing that I'm not going to read to you from anything because I'm writing it at the moment, but I wanted to show you this case because it has a number of really interesting elements to it that really sort of build up the story in different layers, in the same way that the concealment of pregnancy does. But this is a different crime. It's somebody's already dead and we've taken them out of the ground, so it's not murder. It's another type of crime altogether. Crime we just don't have anymore, thank goodness. So again, it's got that sort of archaic feel, which, you know, Burke and Hare is one of the most, one of the crimey things of Edinburgh that people are interested in more than anything else. Edinburgh seems to have this love of raising the dead and digging up bodies and stuff. It seems to be a really, really potent part of Edinburgh's history. This case is from Glasgow, and they're going on. It's going on all over the place, because you can find in the precognitions, you find cases of Stirling, Aberdeen, and all sorts of other places, the borders, and then you bring them up to Edinburgh to be dealt with. So what do I have here? I have the violating the sepulchres of the dead. And why I thought this was interesting is because, here's the first little quote, again, from a document there. What is the document that I've got? It is from Mr. Simpson of Glasgow to the Advocate. Well, I don't know who he is. It didn't matter to me who he was, because this is when I'm kind of not quite a historian. I'm a novelist and a historian. So the provenance of the document doesn't matter too much to me. It's the content and what they're talking about that really matters to me. But this is, you know, I don't like to use the word fun, but it's quite interesting to read this. There have of late been so many bodies stolen from the burying ground in this city, Glasgow, and particularly from the high churchyard, that the citizens have formed a society and now keep watchmen in pay for the purpose of protecting graves. In these circumstances, it is natural the public should feel anxious that any individuals detained, as Carmichael has been, should be brought to trial. Right, so this is happening all the time. It's happening so often that we've now, you know, the people have got a gang of watchmen paid to stop the medical students digging stuff up. So if we catch you, you must go to trial to, you know, make an example of you, to put off the other students. Carmichael is one who's caught doing this. But it's not quite as simple as that, because you think, well, poor Carmichael, he's just the unlucky one. He's just been caught. They're obviously all doing it. So, you know, it's a bit of a shame. But then we find this in another document, you know, because it's not quite as simple as the fact that, oh dear, he's the unlucky one. We also find, rather more than a month ago, Carmichael was put in prison in consequence of raising a dead body. He's done it already. Well, it's not the first time. He's put in prison for raising a dead body. And what he actually does, he gets his friends, and because he's not a wealthy student, which is why he's doing it. If you were a wealthier student, you'd probably pay a grave robber. You would pay someone else to do it. If you're not wealthy, you could do it yourself. Sounds terrible, doesn't it? But, you know, you want to learn to be a doctor? Dig up a body. It just seems to be like that's, you know, anatomy 101. Dig yourself up a body. But he's done this before, so he's been caught. Obviously a sloppy grave robber. Been caught before. He's put in prison, and then the wife of the deceased is paid off. So, because she's not wealthy, you know, she's given, well, you know, here's 10 shillings. Is that all right then? Okay, I'll take the money and I'll drop any charges. So he's let out. So he's already been accused before. So it's not quite this, it's in a different kind of case starting to emerge here. It's not just he's the unlucky one. He's very unlucky because he's been caught more than once. So he's already been in prison. So, yes, there we go. Dr. Corkindale visited him in prison, and he was almost immediately liberated on bail. The woman, the corpse of whose husband it was that he had raised, has been bought off. They actually use this language. This is from the documents. I thought that was quite modern language, really, to be bought off. Obviously, used in 1823 as well. The matter is therefore regarded as at an end. It is to be hoped that Mr. Carmichael will, by what has happened, be taught circumspection for the future. So we've caught him once. He's been taught circumspection. Does that just mean be a bit more careful? Doesn't mean don't do it, does it? It just means, look, you know, watch out next time you're robbing. Keep an eye out. Clearly a little clumsy there because he's been caught again. So we've got that. So this interesting picture is emerging. So then we have this next one. This case becomes one that excites the feeling of people. Okay, so people become quite excited by this. It excited the much feeling and interest on the part of the people. And because people were quite interested in this case, And there were questions around whether it should be followed up or not, because I think some people didn't want Carmichael to be fully brought to trial. But there's a lot of unrest in Glasgow about the grave robbing. So what they decide to do is, well, we can't try him in Glasgow. Bring him over to Edinburgh. Glasgow's getting a bit angry about this, so you're getting this kind of, you know, angry mob feeling from Glasgow. The way Glaswegians, they can do angry mob quite well, I suspect. Bring him to Edinburgh, leave the mob over there, so he can be tried over here when there, you know, there isn't some chanting crowd outside the courthouse. So, you know, it's becoming something that he has to be brought here for his trial, which I thought was quite interesting. A lot of people are getting very concerned by this. And we do know, you know, we know from history that people were very upset by grave robbers. But this is quite an interesting case to actually read about it live in the documents themselves. And again, considering the nature of the crime and the local feeling it may have created, this little letter here, this is the one saying, can we bring him to Edinburgh? We'll try him in Edinburgh instead of leaving him in Glasgow, because, you know, things are getting a little bit overwrought over in Glasgow. So I had another letter that I didn't put up here because the handwriting was so bad, I just didn't photograph it. And it took me ages to read it. And it's interesting, I think, for a number of reasons. And what it says is, it's the testimony from Dr. Meeklehem, who's at what they call Glasgow College, Glasgow University, Glasgow Medical School. So he's based there. Hoping that the public prosecutor will not think it necessary to bring Carmichael to a jury. So this letter is trying to get Carmichael off the hook so he doesn't have to be tried. An unfortunate lad of the name of Carmichael, who is just now under accusation and bail for violating a sepulchre in Glasgow. He is connected to a family I mentioned to you today, and he had great merit in getting himself educated upon very slender means, and has a high character from all the professors with whom he has been. The indictment against him would be utter ruin on the financial state of his education, and his friends are not able to pay the bail that has been exacted. So he's a poor student, all his tutors really like him, and will never get, you know, he can't get the bail, he hasn't got any money, so he's stuck in prison, he's going to ruin his career. You know, he's only doing this to try and get on. But I thought this was quite interesting, because they're kind of trying to get him off the hook, but also this letter is written, it's like really quickly, and I got the sense it's like, oh no, not Carmichael again. How many times am I going to have to write these notes trying to get this lad off the hook? Because it's kind of scribbled down. It was great speed. It was difficult to read. And it just, maybe that wasn't the case. But, you know, again, as a novelist, maybe that's another sort of layer of interpretation that you put on things. It's written quickly. Why would it be written so quickly? Is there some irritation building up that this chap is maybe not as proficient at robbing graves as they would like him to be? So that was, I'm afraid I haven't got a picture of that. But the next one I have, which is kind of the conclusion to this little case, is because Carmichael ends up, he doesn't, I looked everywhere to see what actually happened to him. And the answer is nothing seemed to have happened to him. So I think he is indeed let off in the end. And then we have this letter, which again is quite difficult to read. And you see at the bottom, it looks rather busy. Lots of little scribbly handwritingy things. And that is because this is a letter asking for action against Carmichael to be dropped. And what we're seeing here is Dr. Meeklehem has gone to the family of the dead man and pretty much said, this poor lad, you know, you're going to ruin his life if you continue with this action. If you withdraw your accusations or let it drop, you know, it'll be better for him. And he's a poor boy and he's living with his widowed mother, which is a bit weird. I didn't have time to follow this up, but at one point they say he's living with his dad. And the next minute they say he's living with his widowed mother and has to support his two children, his two sisters. So there's a bit of a unclear information. But in this document, they kind of really sort of bring out his unlucky life, right? So this is a letter to try and... This is the family saying, all right, we let him off then. And it says, as we, the nearest relations of the deceased John Dempster, that was the corpse, late labourer of Glasgow, have no desire that James Carmichael, student of medicine in Glasgow, should be prosecuted at the instance of His Majesty's advocate, or at the instance of us, or any other person for violating the sepulchre of the said John Dempster. We request that the Crown lawyer will consider this as an urgent application on our behalf to stop further proceedings against the said James Carmichael. Besides not wishing to hurt the young man's prospects in life, we make this request in consequence of his being the only support of his sisters and his mother, who is now a helpless widow, which is, tragic. My heart bleeds. And yet, you know, there's previous bits in all these papers that indicate he was living with his dad. So, you know, I'm not quite sure what was going on. This comes from the doctor. So Meeklehem, it's my impression, Meeklehem has gone round and said, look, don't ruin the lad's life. Probably here's a few shillings. Can you drop the charges? And they do. And this is interesting because they can't write. So this mess at the bottom, that says his mark. And that's the widow, and there's a cross, her mark. So they can't write. These are very, very poor people who probably would have taken a few shillings for the case to be dropped because they have no money. You know, so I felt it was a really interesting case for a number of things. He's done it before. He gets caught. He gets let off. You get the medical men stepping in. You get the family bought off to some extent. So all of that, you know, just from a few papers in this archive, and you get the language. You know, there's some private correspondence. The whole thing struck me as really interesting, as well as being a macabre and gothic crime that we just don't see now, which in itself is intriguing and rather appealing. So those are the sort of three or four crimes I wanted to speak to you about, and to try and give you some idea that it's not that you don't pick up a whole story from here when you're using the resources that you've got in the archive. It's that fabulous lucky dip approach, which you don't get as a historian, because you go to the archive looking for a specific thing because, you know, you're writing your historical paper. As a fiction writer, you can just go in, get a thing, get a precognition, and have a look at it, and there'll be something in it that you can use, that you can draw on for a short story, for a character, for a situation, for anything of that kind. It's a fabulous resource, and I think we're so lucky in Edinburgh having these things that we can look at. Thank you.
This podcast was produced for National Records of Scotland by Ross Truslove. It's copyright of National Records of Scotland, and all rights are reserved.